For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good morning, everyone. Many of us are sitting this morning, this beautiful summer morning. Welcome to the folks that have just joined us. So my name is Gyoshin Laurel Ross. Our teacher, Taigen Dan Layton, is away, and so I'll be doing the talk today. The last talk I did here was on Father's Day, and it was about the Bodhisattva ideal. And I seem to be stuck on that, so I'm going to continue on that topic today. I always loved the Bodhisattva ideal. And I'll review for just a few minutes. In case you're unfamiliar with this term Bodhisattva, it's a compound word, Bodhi, which means enlightenment, and Sattva, which means being. So Bodhisattva is an enlightenment being. And when we use this term Bodhisattva to address each other, often I might have said this morning, good morning, Bodhisattvas. When we use this term like that, we're recognizing that we have all made this commitment to sit Zazen together, and that sitting in Zazen is itself an experience of awakening. So in Mahayana Buddhism, which Zen is part of, Bodhisattva refers to a person who is committed to attaining enlightenment, but for the sake of relieving the suffering of all beings. And you could even say that's the goal of Mahayana Buddhism or Zen Buddhism, so much as we would admit to having a goal. So in Soto Zen, we aspire to enlightenment, to free not ourselves from suffering, but out of compassion for other sentient beings. And it's really not a status that we would attain. It's really a way of living our life. So Suzuki Roshi, founder of our Soto Zen lineage at the San Francisco Zen Center, says, "Strictly speaking, there are no enlightened people. There is only enlightened activity." And Shakyamuni is said to have told his disciples, "Go forth for the welfare of the many." So, furthermore, this Bodhisattva life is not just for special people that that can live a life of great discipline off alone in a monastery or a forest. And Mahayana Buddhism encourages everyone to take the Bodhisattva vows and be a Bodhisattva and live this life of relieving suffering of all beings. And I just have to say, this is a very attractive picture of the world to me, that we would live on this planet and everyone would be doing this Bodhisattva activity. But the question is, how do we do this? How do we do this amazing thing? How do we cultivate compassion for all sentient beings? All sentient beings is very inclusive. Sometimes I find myself drawing the line somewhere before I get to ticks and chiggers, which sounds a little bit like a wisecrack, but I'm going to come back to that. So I want to suggest today that an important component of the worldview of a bodhisattva is humility. So humility comes from the root word humus, which is what? It's organic material that comes from decomposition of plant and animal material, and it's what gives us fertility on Earth. So what I want to take issue with is this, what's sometimes referred to as human exceptionalism. So human exceptionalism is this worldview that humans are different from and superior to all other organisms. And that pretty much human behavior is controlled by free will and our culture, and problems can be solved by human ingenuity and technology. It's sort of the opposite of humility. I'm going to put in opposition to that a worldview that comes from one of my favorite Buddhists, Albert Einstein. He says, as a human being, one has been endowed with just enough intelligence to be able to see clearly how utterly inadequate that intelligence is when confronted with what exists. And, you know, Zazen is an important path to softening ourselves and developing metta or loving kindness. But in addition, I think we can develop humility and compassion just by learning more about what exists. And 21st century science seems to be catching up with Shakyamuni and Dogen and others who had great insights into the nature of reality, of what exists. I have a whole pile of books here, not because I'm going to talk about all of them, but you may be interested in them after the talk. There's a lot of stuff in 21st century science that resonates with Zen and Buddhism. So on our recent camping session, Nathan Strait, who is one of our Sangha members who lives in Michigan now, gave a talk he titled Sentience and Problems. And he used a book by Franz de Waal, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? And de Waal points out that when we humans test the intelligence of other creatures, we use measures that greatly favor our strengths. he notes that termites have done a much better job of social coordination. Bats can locate their food by sound. Octopuses have a brain in each one of their arms, so they are really good at multitasking, something we pretend to do but have no way of doing because we only have one brain. And that we haven't really until recently considered those kinds of abilities when we're looking at animal intelligence. So he says, there are many ways to process, organize, and spread information, and it's only recently that science has become open-minded enough to treat all these different methods with wonder and amazement rather than dismissal and denial. So I'm going to invite us to stretch ourselves to be humble when we consider the other kinds of sentient beings in the world. And at this point, it is thought that there are about a trillion species on this planet. And many of those are very, very tiny. which reminds me to mention that in our own body, there are quite a few of these tiny beings. Several pounds of our body weight are our microbiome, as it's called. It's just this collection of these little microbes that play a key role in our life processes. So, in other words, we are them and they are us. And I think according to Mahayana Buddhism, they all have Buddha nature, and according to some definitions of sentience, they may have that too. So one of my favorite things in Buddhist teachings, and we use this word in our opening chant just this morning, is the time period called a kalpa. So a kalpa is defined by this image. If there's a giant rock, a mile cube rock, and a piece of silk brushes over it once every 100 years, by the time that rock is completely worn away, a kalpa would not be complete. So that's a mind stretcher, and it's a sort of a humility builder. But I say that because to just remind us that we humans we're a blip in time. Our universe is thought to be about 14 billion years old. Our solar system and our Earth is thought to be about 4.5 billion years old. And if you put that 4.5 billion years on a one-year time scale, you know, life wouldn't have started on Earth until like April of that year. And those would be single-celled animals. And anything resembling human beings, like Cro-Magnon man or something, wouldn't show up until 5 minutes before midnight on December 31st. So a lot has gone on this planet and in this universe before we were even present in any way. And so we're this blip, and sometimes recently it doesn't look like we're going to be around a whole lot longer even. But anyway, another mind stretcher comes from a book about plants, of all things. It's called Brilliant Green, and it's by this Italian plant physiologist named Stefano Mancuso. So Michael Pollan, who's written lots of very interesting things about plants himself, says about Mancuso that he has the ability to see the world from a completely fresh and unencumbered point of view. So here's what Mancuso says. He says, in biology, we call a species dominant when it obtains more living space at other species' expense, thus showing more adaptability to the environment than its competitors and a superior capacity to solve the problems faced by each living being in the struggle for survival. So that makes sense, right? It's dominant if it can succeed. So it's usually said that the Earth is dominated by humans. That's our way of thinking of this globe. But consider this. So on Earth, 99.7% of the biomass, so that's all living things, is composed of plants. All animals, of which humans are just a subset, are 0.03% of the biomass on the planet. So Mancuso asks, how do we reconcile this fact with a completely human assumption that we are the dominant species? We can control the planet, and we have greater rights than other species. There can only be one explanation, he says. Plants are much more advanced, adaptable, and intelligent beings than we are inclined to think. So these authors define intelligence as the ability to solve problems, not the ability to think abstractly. But this begs the question, like, which of those abilities is more valuable? So I'm just going to keep going with some stories about sort of the rest of creation and read a poem by Jim Harrison. I know, do people familiar with the writer Jim Harrison? This is a poem called Warbler. Jane's a fan of warblers. It's a little bird. This year, we have two gorgeous yellow warblers nesting in the honeysuckle bush. The other day, I stuck my head in the bush. The nestlings weigh 1/20th of an ounce, about the size of a honeybee. We stared at each other, startled by our existence. In a month or so, when they reach the size of bumblebees, they'll fly to Costa Rica without a map. I love that poem. And I love birds. When it comes to birds, I wear my heart on my sleeve. And I've been reading this other new book about animal intelligence called The Genius of Birds by Jennifer Ackerman, which is one of the birds in this pile here that you can look at later if you're interested. Many, many, many interesting things about birds we're learning. A bird called the Clark's Nutcracker can hide as many as 30,000 seeds over dozens of square miles and remember where it put them several months later. Mockingbirds and thrashers can store 200 to 2,000 different songs in a brain 1,000 times smaller than ours. and migration, the Arctic tern can fly more than 49,700 miles in a year, making a round trip between their breeding grounds in the Arctic and the Antarctic, where they spend their winters. Over its lifespan of more than 30 years, the flights add up to the equivalent of 3 trips to the moon and back. It weighs about 3.5 ounces. So she also points out the social abilities of birds. They deceive and manipulate. They eavesdrop. They display a strong sense of fairness. They give gifts. They play keep away and tug of war. They tease. They share. They cultivate social networks. They vie for status. They kiss to console one another. They teach their young. They blackmail their parents. They alert one another to danger. They summon witnesses to the death of a peer. They may even grieve. So not so long ago, when I was in school, which was long ago, but even more recent than that, this kind of writing would have been trashed by the scientific world as sentimental anthropomorphism. But more recently, the evidence has really become impossible to ignore. And so the more we pay attention to the other sentient beings on the planet, the more foolish and preposterous, actually, the idea of human superiority seems. I even respect the tick that I mentioned earlier when I learned that it could spend as long as 18 years waiting on a blade of grass for a mammal to pass by so it could hop on and get the blood that it needs to actually survive. That's pretty cool. But the real thing I want to say is we don't have to decide who is superior or inferior or more or less intelligent if we acknowledge, understand, believe, and live the Buddhist view that we're pretty much all part of the same thing. As Suzuki Roshi says, wherever you are one with the clouds, one with the sun and stars. You're one with everything. That is more true than I can say and more true than you can hear. So a human being and a grain of rice share 25% of our DNA. That is to say, 25% of our human DNA is the same as a rice plant. And we share DNA with coral and rhinoceroses and fungi, and all plants and animals and living beings share an ancestor from like 1.5 billion years ago. So last week, The New Yorker had this very cool article that I really liked. In fact, I thought for a while that I was just going to read that article and that was going to be my whole Dharma talk, but I thought I'd get in trouble if I did that. So I'm going to just read you a few short excerpts, and if you want to look it up, it's by Robert McFarlane, who's a plant physiologist, really, really cool British guy. It's a little long, but it's really fun. For centuries, fungi were widely held to be harmful to plants, parasites that cause disease and dysfunction. More recently, it has become understood that certain kinds of common fungi exist in subtle symbiosis with plants, bringing about not infection, but connection. These fungi send out gossamer fine fungal tubes called hyphae, which infiltrate the soil and weave into the tips of plant roots. Roots and fungi combine to form what is called a mycorrhizae. In this way, individual plants are joined to one another by an underground hyphal network, a dazzlingly complex and collaborative structure that has become known as the Wood Wide Web. The relationship between these mycorrhizal fungi and the plants they connect is now known to be ancient, around 450 million years old, and largely one of mutualism in which both organisms benefit. The fungi get food from the trees, which photosynthesize, and then the plants get nutrients such as phosphorus and nitrogen that the fungi get from the soil. The implications of the Wood Wide Web far exceed this basic exchange of goods between plant and fungi, however. The fungal network also allows plants to distribute resources, sugar, nitrogen, phosphorus, between one another. A dying tree might divest itself of its resources to the benefit of the community, for example. or a young seedling in a heavily shaded understory might be supported with extra resources by its stronger neighbors. Even more remarkably, the network also allows plants to send one another warnings. A plant under attack from aphids can indicate to a nearby plant that it should raise its defensive response before the aphids reach it. The revelation of the Wood Wide Web's existence and the increased understanding of its functions raises big questions about where species begin and end, about whether a forest might be better imagined as a single superorganism rather than a grouping of independent, individualistic ones, and about what trading, sharing, or even friendship might mean among plants. So on that thought, I'm going to end with wisdom from the three teachers that have meant the most to me in my practice. And I'm going to begin with Dogen, founder of Soto Zen in 13th century Japan, who just dazzles me. He says, "Now, human beings well know as water what is in the ocean and what is in the river. But they do not know what dragons and fish see as water and use as water. Do not foolishly suppose that what we see as water is used as water by all other beings. You who study with Buddhists should not be limited to human views when you're studying water. It's not only that there is water in the world, but there is a world in water. It's not just in water. There's also a world of sentient beings in clouds. There's a world of sentient beings in the air. There's a world of sentient beings in fire. There's a world of sentient beings on earth. There's a world of sentient beings in the phenomenal world. There's a world of sentient beings in a blade of grass." Oh, Dogen. Anyway, and then second, Suzuki Roshi. "Although we practice with people, our goal is to practice with mountains and rivers, with trees and stones, with everything in the world, everything in the universe, and to find ourselves in this big cosmos. When we practice in this big world, we know intuitively which way to go." And then last of all, a very short quote from Gary Snyder, who reminds us, "Nature is orderly. That which appears to be chaotic in nature is only a more complex kind of order." So thank you for your attention. We do have time for comments, thoughts. And I can show you what these books are if you're at all interested. "What a Plant Knows," "The Soul of an Octopus," "Mind of the Raven," "Brilliant Green," "Genius of Birds," "Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are?" and "Buddhist Biology." And I bring this only to say these are all pretty new books, and there's a million of them. And it's because there is this sort of new understanding in the scientific world of ecology, biology, plant physiology, and so forth that is very, very resonant with people like Dogen. So, I did come back and said that I do respect them because they stay on the blade of grass for 18 years waiting for me to walk by. And then they jump on me. I spend a fair amount of time in prairies where they hang out on blades of grass. And sometimes I find them in my washing machine or on my pillow or in my sock. On my cat.
I'm wondering, as a Buddhist and scientist, how you reconcile sort of more classical scientific, Darwinistic understanding of if we are to survive, we gotta do that at these friends of others. The quote you had from the Italian had a little this dominance, and competition in there, and then the Buddhist understanding that if I'm harming you, I'm harming.
Yeah, so survival of the fittest is usually the way they summarize Darwin. But I would recommend people actually read Darwin. Darwin was an amazing observer of life. He, people probably know he did this as a very young man, he did this really long trip from England to the Galapagos and all over the tropics, just looking at things at a time when, you know, Europe, which was sort of the seat of classical knowledge, didn't know very much about the rest of the world. And he's looking at it with these really fresh eyes and trying to just understand how all this stuff fit together. And he really had a very holistic view of how this world worked. And so his way of describing what is usually summarized as this sort of dog-eat-dog world, or I guess whatever dogs eat, I mean, you know, this kills that, is really a much more holistic view of this is how it all how it all came to be through this process of evolution, and this is how it works. And so it's really not so much as you you're the winner if you have a battle with a whatever we some animal that we would be eating, a deer, say, so much as the way it all works is enough deer are born that some of them can feed other animals, and it is actually not winners and losers unless we make it that way. And sometimes I think humans do tend to want to make it that way. So I don't know if that's a clear answer, but Darwin in particular was very, very, he was a naturalist, so he spent a lot of time in his garden just like looking at petunias, trying to figure them out. Yes?
When you say, unless we make it that way, you're not actually saying, but I wonder if you're kind of implying, that it has to do with that sense of I, that
yeah.
you want to cling to so
yeah.
badly.
Yeah.
I want to be the one that survives.
Right.
But it seems like with, you didn't say enough for me to get this, but it sounded like maybe with plants, they can just alert the others, like with the aphids sort of thing. I don't know how much a plant is clinging to an eye versus just saying, hey, there's something going on over here, you need to like raise your defenses so you don't get eaten by aphids.
So I think if you think of the forest as what he called a superorganism, that there isn't an eye in there. And if we think of the planet as a superorganism, there aren't eyes in there. Although, like if we look at the microbiome in our own body, for example, so there's little organisms helping us to digest and helping our liver to function, helping in our mouth, and each one of those, could have an I, an ego, except no, it's part of, it's doing its sort of function, and I sort of see us all as functioning in this big tapestry of life on Earth over time and over space. It's quite beautiful. And then when you die, you're just humus, right? It's good. Your fertility, it makes it, for me anyway, comforting and right on some deep level, not something to be avoided or feared or horrified by.
Thank you for this talk. I have just reread a novel, it's really a treatise. It's called Chronicle Summer by Margaret Kingsolver, who is a scientist. She's also a botanist. Throughout this makes a number of points that, a number of different points, but one is that it's about balance, you know, and that when we mess with it, sometimes we can really screw up the balance. The other thing, she kind of goes through the eyes of the coyote at the very end of this and makes the point that as that they're similar to us. We're not that different in some ways. We have biological needs and urges, and we're driven by similar things, but that they think of the world probably in terms of not being solitary, not being individual, but being part of a much larger system that they're constantly part of. And so it's interesting because it is, she gives lots of facts and figures in a friendly way.
She's a very good writer. Yeah, I mean, my problem is with this idea of humans are superior and exceptional, and it just seems flat out wrong to me. So that's, I did my best to say that, but and it ends up being destructive to ourselves as well as to the rest of the planet, because it's a false assumption to operate on. So if we think we run this place, it's folly. For us, probably, more than anything else. Did you have something to say, Brian? I saw your hand go up. Oh. Intuition.
This notion of the forest as one organism, I've often thought of the entire material universe, and maybe non-material too, I don't know, as one vast organism.
Yeah.
But it's very different from I'm going to be one with you, or I'm going to learn my oneness with nature out there. It's more like human beings are like a tear duct in the body or a fingernail.
Right.
We're just part of this organism.
Yeah.
So if the coral reefs are dying, it's not this object out there that's having a problem. It's like my finger hurts. Our coral reef hurts.
Right. That the oceans are in such trouble is very, very painful to all of us. I mean, it matters to all of us because we're part of that.